We are in Genesis chapter 31. We are making our way through this book, and it's been great so far. We move a little further into Jacob's life today. In this passage before us, we have a lot really unfold. We will see a stark difference in the lives of two men here in this passage primarily. One who is in a covenantal relationship with God, and one who we will see walk away from God despite all evidence to point to God. The title of my sermon this afternoon is, Are You a Child of God or Are You a Child of the World? Jacob has been with Laban for 20 years at this point, when we get to chapter 31. He's worked hard and long. For the most part, he'd worked for wages for his two wives. The wages that he'd worked for were his two wives. But Jacob had gone to Laban previously, in the previous chapter in fact, and had asked to go back to Canaan. He wanted to return to his homeland. Really, he was asking for Laban's blessing to return to Canaan. He was asking him if it would be all right for him to leave and go back. But Jacob had been so valuable to Laban up to that point that he told Jacob just to name his wages. Whatever he wanted, he would pay him if he would just stay. And Jacob did in fact do that. He named wages, and Jacob stayed to work for Laban for some longer period of time. Now Jacob had been told by God years ago, prior to even coming in to Laban's home, that he was the one whom God's promise, the same promise that he gave to Abraham, the same promise that he gave to Isaac, would go through him. And because of that, God would bless him and he would keep him. So maybe Jacob should have just left the first time he went to Laban and trusted God would take care of him. But he didn't, and he agreed to these new wages with Laban. Wages that were not in his favor to begin with, as Brian brought out last week. He went to Laban, he asked Laban for his wages to be livestock that would be a recessive gene. The livestock that he would get from Laban were livestock that were only reproduced in a recessive gene, meaning that it would be much harder for him to gain livestock. To make matters worse, after their agreement, if you remember, Laban took every lamb in the flock that Jacob was taking care of who had any type of mark on it that could possibly be prone to produce a spotted or speckled offspring and put those in the flock of his son, who was a good 3 days journey away from Jacob, effectively taking away any chance in Laban's mind of Jacob being able to produce any wages for himself. The likelihood that Jacob would amass any type of real flock for himself as wages any time in the next decade, really, was next to nothing after Laban did that. But yet, Jacob thrived. Against all odds, Jacob thrived. In fact, as we begin this chapter, Jacob has thrived so much that the sons of Laban began to accuse him of stealing, basically. Let's read. Verse 1 says, Now Jacob heard that the sons of Laban were saying, Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has gained all this wealth. And Jacob saw that Laban did not regard him with favor as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, Return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you. So here we see these sons of Laban basically accusing Jacob of stealing the flock that used to be their father Laban's flock for himself, doing something. They didn't really know what it was, but he was doing something, and what he was doing was taking away from their father's flock. And in truth, Jacob's flock had grown exponentially during these years of work for Laban. And by contrast, Laban's flock had decreased exponentially, I'm sure. Laban's sons, though, obviously had forgotten Jacob had worked for about 15 years prior to this for basically free. And he'd worked for two wives, but that had cost Laban nothing. It had cost Laban nothing out of his flock. In fact, Jacob had increased Laban's flock exponentially during that period of time. Now, not only did the sons of Laban begin to grow weary against Jacob, but also we read here that Laban begins to grow hostile towards Jacob. Laban was more than happy to take from Jacob as long as it benefited from him. He was more than happy to do that. But now as he sees the tables start to turn, as he sees that he's beginning to be blessed, and, or that Jacob's beginning to be blessed instead of him, it begins to sour Laban towards Jacob. This just reaffirms to us the type of person that Laban was. He loved Jacob when Jacob was working and doing for him. But again, as his wealth began to diminish, it began to turn him against Jacob. And it was at this point that we read that the Lord came to Jacob. The Lord comes to Jacob. Jacob had been away from Canaan, about 20 years now. It's been a little over 2 decades that he's been away from his home. He'd attempted to go back, as we mentioned, a few years prior, but had been lured to stay by the promises of wages and of having his own flock. But Jacob's time of being away from the promised land has come to an end, and God tells him to return, and again, promises that he would be with him, much the same promise that he gave him back in Bethel. Now, as far as we know, God had not come to Jacob in this way since that time at Bethel, since before Jacob actually made it to the home of Laban. And if that, in fact, was the case, then I'm sure as God came to him at this time, it would have brought back to Jacob's mind that meeting, that time that he met God at Bethel. It would have brought back the promises that God made to him at that time as well. But it would have brought back to him the remembrance that his blessings were tied to a specific land. They were tied to a specific place. They were tied to the land of Canaan. And as I stated, Jacob has been away for about 20 years now. But it's time for him to be about the Lord's business. And to Jacob's credit, as we read here, there seems to be no argument from him. He doesn't seem to fight with the Lord about this. We just seem to see immediate obedience from him. In a way, that might not have been too tough for him. I mean, as we've seen, working for Laban was hard. It had become fruitful for Jacob, but not because Laban had made it easy. Laban had made it very difficult on Jacob. But this is still a place he'd been for 20 years. I'm sure there are some roots that he'd put down at this point. Not only that, it's the only home that his wives had known. It's the only family that his wives and his children had known, and the only home that his children had known. So even though Jacob might not have had an easy time working for Laban, this call by God for Jacob to pick up and move wasn't necessarily easy on him. I've said it before, but when Hannah and I moved to Vernon, it was only through a long period of prayer and careful thought, and it was hard in many ways. We were moving less than 100 miles away and less than an hour away. We were moving to a place where she had been, Micah had been, they knew my family, been around them a good bit. They were familiar with the area and the people there. But Jacob was going hundreds of miles away and weeks of a trip away from where they'd been, from where Rachel and Leah and his children had been their entire lives. And they were going to a place where his family had never met anyone there. They didn't know Jacob's family at all. They didn't know anyone there. This was an example of great faith on the part of Jacob to just pick up and decide to move, to decide to obey God in doing this. And we also should live our lives in such a way that we are open to God's will for us, no matter what that might be. God doesn't speak to us audibly as he spoke to Jacob here, but he does lead us by the Holy Spirit, and he guides us by his word. And if that leading calls us to step out in faith, then we should be ready and willing as Jacob was here. We shouldn't expect material blessings necessarily as Jacob would get as part of this promise, but we should always remember that God is always working things out for our good, and that is worthy of our faith and our obedience. So Jacob had likely decided that this was the move, that this was what they were going to do. But as a good husband, he goes to his wives. Hopefully, a good husband today goes to his wife, not his wives. But Jacob had two here. So he goes to his wives, and in verse 4 it says, "So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah into the field where his flock was, and said to them, 'I see that your father does not regard me with favor as he did before. But the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not permit him to harm me. If he said, the spotted shall be your wages, then all the flock bore spotted. And if he said, the stripes shall be your wages, then all the flock bore striped. Thus God has taken away the livestock of your father and has given them to me. In the breeding season of the flock, I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream that the goats were mated with the flock, were striped, spotted, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in a dream, Jacob, and I said, here I am. And he said, lift up your eyes and see all the goats that mate with the flock are striped, spotted, and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise, go out from this land and return to the land of your kindred. As Jacob goes to Rachel and Leah here, he begins to speak to them about what God has told him to do. This necessity to go back to the land of Canaan. He calls their attention to the fact that at this point, their father Laban had lost all favor in him. Where once he had favor on him, now he has no more favor on Jacob. And in doing so, he calls them to witness that he had worked hard for their father this entire time. In fact, he says that he had served him with all his strength. And I have no reason to doubt Jacob. I mean, not only had the flock been prosperous, that Laban's flock had been prosperous. Laban, in fact, as we know, wanted Jacob there because of that. Jacob gives us no reason to doubt that he was a hard worker and that he had done well and worked with all his strength for Laban. And that service had not been fair or easy during his time with Laban. As we read here, he says that Laban had changed his wages 10 times. Now, that could have been just a euphemism for a lot of changes. It doesn't necessarily have to mean 10 specific times that wages were changed. The way of putting it today could have been he changed his wages time and time again or over and over. And whether it was 10 times or less or more, it had been a lot. Laban had constantly changed Jacob's wages, and all in an effort to cheat Jacob. If you remember, as soon as Laban had agreed to terms with Jacob in the previous chapter, some 6 years prior to this, Laban had gone and taken out all the spotted, speckled, and made it hard, as we mentioned to begin with in this sermon, made it hard on Jacob to reproduce. He did that switcheroo there, and he thought Jacob would have little success afterwards. But as we see here, that didn't stop. Laban didn't stop there. As Jacob started to have success against all odds, Laban would go back to Jacob and he'd change wages from what he originally agreed to with Jacob. When all the spotted lambs began to be plentiful, Laban went to Jacob and said basically, hey Jacob, so I've decided that the spotted flocks are going to be my wages, or going to be mine now, and your wages are going to be the striped flocks. That's just how it's going to be. That's what we're going to do. But the striped lambs began to become plentiful, and as soon as that happened, Laban went back to Jacob and said, all right, I've changed my mind, changed the plans, now I'm going to get the striped flock, you're going to get the spotted again. That's just how this is going to go. And it seems like he did that over and over during this period of time. Yet, in spite of all that, and in spite of all odds, Jacob prospered. Each time he changed the flock, which Laban thought was going to end up being prosperous for him, God changed it and made it prosperous for Jacob. But we see here that Laban was a truly selfish and conniving man. He should have been happy for his son-in-law and his two daughters and his grandsons, that they were starting to become plentiful, that they started to get wages, that they were going to have enough for themselves. But he wasn't. He wasn't, because it was taking away from him, and it was at his expense. Notice in this also, Jacob had shown great restraint in this whole dealing, all of his dealings with Laban. He seemed to have just taken all of these changes in stride and without complaint. There's no indication he ever complained to Laban when he'd go and have these wages changed. Now, maybe that restraint came from a respect in the fact that this was his father-in-law and he needed to have respect for his father-in-law, or maybe it was in the fact that he was working for Laban and Laban was essentially his boss. I believe Jacob was showing the same type of principle here that Paul teaches in 1 Timothy chapter 6 when he taught to respect those who we work for. Our bosses and our jobs might be hard at times, they might be unfair at times, but we are called to work hard and show respect no matter what may be in front of us. that gives glory to God, and it shows that we are children of God in doing that. Notice also here who Jacob credits for his success. Now, I know for most of us, we probably would not have had this type of response. How easy would it have been for Jacob to just look at all his success over the years and think it was a result of his great abilities, of all of himself? There was no doubt he was a gifted shepherd. But Jacob knew that those gifts, his gift as a gifted shepherd, came from God. And he also knew that God was the one who had made the difference in his dealings with Laban during these years. Now, last week we saw where Jacob had peeled sticks, if you remember. He peeled sticks and he placed these sticks in front of the flocks when they came to water and to breed. As Brian mentioned last week, that could have been some type of superstition, or it could have been a breeding technique that technology hadn't quite shown to be nonsense yet. And maybe Jacob at that point held to that silly superstition or that silly breeding technique. We don't know for sure, but we do know that at this point, Jacob knew in his conversation with Leah and Rachel that ultimately the success he had came directly and solely because of God. Now, that realization might have fully set in once God had come to him in this dream and told him that specifically. But there's no question at this point in Jacob's mind and his heart that God had been with him and was responsible for his success. Now, we can't know for sure. This is kind of a little side note. We can't know for sure, but it's hard not to believe that if Laban had treated Jacob honestly and fairly during this period of time and not tried to harm him by cheating him so often, then both he and Jacob could have prospered in their dealings, and God wouldn't have dealt so harshly with Laban in these years. We do know that God does not take lightly when one of his children are mistreated, and he doesn't honor greed or someone who only cares about themselves. Laban was greedy and only cared about himself, and Laban had mistreated Jacob. And for that, it seems like God deals harshly with him in these years, and it blesses Jacob in spite of all those dealings. Jacob goes on in this conversation to tell Leah and Rachel about the dream that he'd had and how God had talked to him and what God had told him to do, and ultimately that was to leave Haran, leave their home, and head back to Canaan. Who knows what Jacob was expecting in response when he finishes this story, but the response he gets had to have been a relief to him. Rachel and Leah's answer was one of full support. There in verse 14 it says, "Then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, 'Is there any portion or inheritance left to us in our father's house? Are we not regarded by him as foreigners? For he has sold us and he has indeed devoured our money. All the wealth that God has taken away from our father belongs to us and to our children. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do.'" They realized that their father had intended to leave them with nothing, with no inheritance really. Now, women at this time weren't generally part of an inheritance, or at least they weren't a great part of an inheritance. It just wasn't done that way. But Laban had repeatedly changed Jacob's wages. And in doing so, he was trying to keep Jacob from having any type of successful flock. And ultimately, what that meant was that he really didn't care for his daughters, or that his daughters were left anything. Didn't care whether they had any type of inheritance or any type of success here with their husband. So they tell Jacob, in light of this, to do whatever God had told him to do. Whatever God had given them was rightfully theirs and their children, and that Jacob should just do whatever God told him to do. Gives them their support. So with his wife's support and God's directive, Jacob sets off back to Canaan. Verse 17 reads, "So Jacob arose and set his sons and his wives on camels. He drove away all his livestock and his property that he had gained, the livestock in his possession that he had acquired in Padan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household gods. And Jacob tricked Laban, the Aramean, by not telling him that he intended to flee. He fled with all that he had and arose and crossed the Euphrates and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead." Now it says here that Jacob drove away all his livestock, and then we see later on in verse 21 it says that he fled and he intended to flee there in verse 21. Jacob left in a hurry. He left fleeing Laban here, basically in fear. Now, we saw some 20 years ago Jacob leave Canaan fleeing and in fear of Esau at that point. And now, again, 20 years later, here we have Jacob again leaving another place, fleeing in fear. Although we've seen growth in Jacob and we've seen faith even in this chapter in Jacob, there still seemed to be a struggle somewhat in Jacob to fully rely on God. God had told him to leave, but he'd mentioned nothing about fleeing, and he'd certainly mentioned nothing about fearing Laban in this matter. Now, we can certainly understand Jacob's thinking here and why he did this. Laban, as we've mentioned over and over, had been unfair to him from the beginning. Jacob knew him to be a man who was only out for himself, and I'm sure Jacob thought that if he had went to Laban, had gone to Laban at this point to tell him that he was packing up, ready to go back home, and he was going to take with him his family, all his grandkids, his daughters, primarily he was going to take the livestock and all the possessions that he'd gained over these last few years, that Laban likely would have done all he could to have stopped Jacob, to have prevented that, and probably not in a peaceful way. And from what we know of Laban, I'm sure Jacob's fear in this would have been right. He would have been right in thinking that Laban would have tried to do that. But Jacob had already witnessed, just recently, had witnessed God thwart Laban's plans over and over, in spite of the impossible, in spite of what seemed to be impossible that any other outcome would take place. And he should have had faith that God would do the same now as well. That said, there's no reason for us to think we would have been the pillar of faith in this situation either. It's easy to let our fears overshadow our faith. We constantly will allow that to happen. If what we see in front of us clashes with what we know God has told us, then we have a tendency to lean toward what we see in front of us instead of leaning on what God has told us. We could do to work on that. Now, we're given another little tidbit here about Rachel in verse 19. We're told that Rachel, before they left, she went to her father's household or house and took away his household gods, took away idols or teraphim. Now, we know that Laban had worshipped idols, so it's possible that Rachel had still held to some of her father's idol worship, that she was still hanging on to some of that and thought there was something to that, and she took these idols for safe travel as they were about to leave and to hold on to a bit of what her former worship had been. There's also another possibility that I found while studying. Apparently, it was the custom of this time that whoever held these idols, these type of idols, it would strengthen their claim to the inheritance, to their inheritance. So maybe Rachel thought that by taking these idols, she was trying to guarantee her right and her claim to the flocks and to the property that they had gained during this time that they were leaving with. And this makes sense considering that seemed to be hers and Rachel's primary concern when Jacob told them they were about to leave. The first thing they talked about was their inheritance. And I tend to lean towards Rachel wanting these idols for safe travels and out of superstition or former worship instead of that. And we don't know much about Rachel and her spiritual state really at this point. But if that was the case, if she was leaning on or she wanted these idols to worship or out of some superstition, and if she was a child of God, she was obviously struggling with being fully committed to God in this moment. And that's much like many Christians around us today, and even us at some points. We know God to be true, but we have trouble letting go of our former lives at times. We have trouble letting go of what we're told to let go of, which is the world, and fully trusting in God. But even if it was she had taken these to ensure that she was going to have an inheritance, it really was not a smart plan. Laban was not the sort to honor these type of things anyways. He wasn't an honorable man from what we've seen, and I certainly feel like he would have not honored this having known that Rachel stole these idols and they were not given to her. Now, it takes Laban 3 days to catch up. We read that in verse 22. It says, when it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him for 7 days and followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. But God came to Laban the Aramean, in a dream by night and said to him, "Be careful not to say anything to God either, to Jacob, either good or bad." It takes Laban 3 days to figure out that they've gone. That may not make a lot of sense to us because we live in a very fast-paced time. Everything's on social media. We can text. You know, we see things on TV. Everything's in the open. But at this point, it makes a lot of sense because if you remember, Laban's sons' flocks were about 3 days away from Jacob. And it says here that Laban had been away a couple verses ago. It says that Laban had been away shearing the sheep. He was likely shearing the sheep of his son's flock, which would have been 3 days. So it had been about 3 days for him to find out that they had left, they'd gone. But as soon as he finds this out, he gathers his kinsmen, gets a group of kinsmen, and he sets out after Jacob. Now there's no doubt in my mind that he has a heart set on harming Jacob and going after him in this way. Although we'll see here in a minute that he tries to claim that this was out of care for his daughters and out of his grandkids and the fact that he didn't get to say bye to them, and ultimately that they took, that he thinks Jacob stole his idols. It's hard to imagine that the true reason was not out of Laban's care for himself and out of the fact that Jacob had taken livestock that he thought was his. He knew he was about to lose. If Laban had shown himself to be a man who cared for his daughters and his grandkids the way he claims as he meets Jacob here in a minute, then Jacob would have not feared to go to him before he left and talk to him and tell him he was leaving. It takes him 7 days to catch up with Jacob. At this point, Laban is hot and heavy. He's been chasing Jacob hard for a week now. He's had plenty of time to think about how much Jacob had taken from him. He probably had his sons with him also as part of the kinsmen. And we know that his sons already felt like Jacob had stolen from their father and taken from their inheritance. And that was when the flocks were still there. I'm sure as they were heading with their father to catch Jacob, they had as much intent on harming Jacob and taking those flocks as what Laban did. But now, Jacob had fled, and with him he'd taken all that had been theirs, and Laban goes to sleep this night. Laban goes to sleep after 7 days of hard journey, and as he goes to sleep, he gets an unsuspected visitor, as we see. God appears to him in a dream. God's message to him is very short and to the point. He tells Laban, don't speak good or bad to Jacob. Basically what he's saying, don't say anything or do anything to try to make Jacob return or keep him from going back to his home. And we will see that Laban does not question or challenge this. That might, to me, as I was reading through this, there's somewhat of a shock there that Laban doesn't try to challenge or question this. That he didn't do that night, or he didn't do it when he meets Jacob. The reason I say that it's somewhat of a shock is because humanity is depraved. We know this. Humanity constantly shakes their fist at God. And we will not obey God for anything in our depraved state. We as changed new creatures have a tough time obeying God at times. And we will tend to shake our fist at God at times. But certainly the depraved nature of humanity does that. But it's only in God's mercy and in His long-suffering that He allows any of that to take place. When God purposes something to be done, it will be done. Eventually, all creation, humanity included, will bow and acknowledge God as King and Creator. Even the lost. They will not do so out of love or out of willing respect for God, but because they'll have no other choice but to bow to the Almighty. And although Laban here did not know God personally or have a true desire to obey Him, when God told him how this conversation would go and how it should go with Jacob, Laban was going to obey that no matter what, because there was no other option here as God had willed that to be the case. Verse 25 reads, "And Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen pitched tents in the hill country of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, 'What have I done, or what have you done, that you have tricked me and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and trick me and did not tell me, so that I might have sent you away with mirth and songs, with tambourine and lyre? And why did you not permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell? Now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to do you harm, But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. And now you have gone away, because you long greatly for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?'" We see here that Laban catches up with Jacob, and he has this meeting with Jacob. And we see God's faithfulness all throughout this little passage right here. The previous passage, as he came to Laban in the dream, and then as this unfolds in this conversation with Jacob, despite Jacob's lack of faith, God still does what he promised that he would do to him. He protects him. He blesses him. He's in with Jacob even in this situation. And I can't help but think of how God came to Pharaoh and came to Abimelech, both in dreams, as Abraham had tried to trick them in fear of his life prior when he lied to him about his relationship with Sarah. In spite of that, God had protected Abraham just as he does here for Jacob. We should gain courage in that, though, as we see this. This is an example that we are imperfect humans. We make mistakes. Thankfully, God still protects us even in our mistakes. It's obviously not a license to make mistakes and to just go out and sin and do wrong. But we serve a God who knows how imperfect we are and how weak we are, and He is merciful to us in spite of that. J.W. Ferguson states, "It is good for us to keep in mind that the promises of God still hold, even when we are conscious of much in our lives which may cause us to be aware of our unworthiness of His love and care. And even more so, on an eternal point, and most importantly, we should keep in mind that we are eternally protected from our mistakes and blessed beyond measure if we stand before God one day in the person and work of Jesus Christ. And we can take comfort in that." Laban meets Jacob here, finally, and he gives him this just ridiculous spiel. In my opinion, this whole thing is just ridiculous, what Laban tries to tell him. He accuses Jacob of forcing his daughters and his grandkids to leave, which we know is not true. We know that's not the case. They went willingly. Then he really lays it on thick by claiming that he would have thrown Jacob and his family this huge party, this banquet, to send them away, had Jacob just told him that they were leaving. Now, after all that we've seen Laban do to Jacob, and we've seen the type of man Laban to be, there's not a chance in my mind that he would have happily sent Jacob away with some type of celebration and with all that Jacob had gained at his expense. Then Laban even tries to claim that this had hurt him because he'd been deprived an opportunity of kissing his daughters and his grandsons goodbye. Now, I'm sure that there was some natural love that Laban had for his family. That's just natural. But that, in my opinion, was way on down the list of reasons why he didn't want Jacob to leave. That wasn't up towards the top like he tried to claim here. All of this that Laban is doing here is really just an attempt to hide his original intent, the reason why he went after Jacob, and to justify him chasing down Jacob in this manner. And as he begins to end this, Laban can't help but try to just make sure Jacob knows that he was a man of power still, and that he had power to harm Jacob. But he wouldn't do it because the God of Jacob's father had come to him the previous night and forbidden it. Now, while it is true that Laban likely still held power over Jacob in the sense that he probably could have done him great harm, he would have been able to overtake him here and do him harm, and that there is truth in that, Laban's purpose behind telling Jacob this whole thing was really just self-serving. He was really just trying to build himself up in this whole thing and save face in this. Then Laban ends with an attempt to justify why they had chased Jacob down, why they had come after him this way. He accuses Jacob of stealing his idol. That's really what he's trying to pin this all on. The reason he chased him down this way is because, hey, Jacob, you stole my idols, and so I had to come get them. I'm sure that Laban probably wanted these idols back, but he most certainly wouldn't have chased Jacob down and used the manpower and resources that he did just to get these idols back, idols that he likely made himself or that he could have had made for him by somebody in the area that he lived. In response, Jacob answers honestly as to why he left. In verse 30, it says, in 31 it says, "Jacob answered and said to Laban, 'Because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force. Anyone with whom you find your God shall not live. In the presence, in the presence of our kinsmen, point out what I have that is yours and take it. Now Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. He was afraid, Jacob was afraid that if he told Laban he was leaving, then Laban would have taken Rachel and Leah by force to prevent them from going, and in that he would have taken the livestock that he'd gained as well by force. Now Jacob doesn't know in this brief conversation here, he doesn't realize that Rachel has stolen these household gods. He's got the accusation, but he has no idea that Rachel has stolen these household gods. I can't help but think as he makes this vow that whoever, if Laban finds these idols, whoever he finds them on, he can put them to death. I can't help but think of Jephthah, who made the vow in Judges that if God would grant him victory in battle, that whoever came or whatever came out of his house first, when he got home, he would offer up to the Lord. It was a rash vow at that point, and this seems to be somewhat of a rash vow here with Jacob, especially him not knowing that Rachel had stolen them. And it makes you kind of wonder what would have happened had this been found out, how Jacob would have responded had Rachel been found out to have taken these idols. But in God's grace, they weren't discovered. Verse 33, so Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two female servants, but he did not find them. And he went out of Leah's tent and into Rachel's. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. Laban felt all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me. So he searched, but did not find the household gods. Laban searches Jacob's tent, he searches Leah's tent, he searches the two handmaidens' tent, and then finally he searches Rachel's tent. And here we see a little bit of Laban and Rachel. We see that Rachel's the true daughter of Laban. As Laban searches the tent, Rachel is sitting down, and she's sitting on this camel's saddle, and she's got these idols hidden up under her in the camel's saddle. It was common for people to use these saddles in a tent, to sit on, almost like furniture, as they would camp for the night or camp for the day. Rachel tells Laban as she's sitting there that she can't get up because she was experiencing a side effect of the curse God gave Eve for eating the apple. It's a delicate way of putting that, I think. This might have been true, it could have been, or it might have just been her trying to deceive Laban and not been true. But either way, Laban buys it and he doesn't find this idol. He doesn't ask her to get up, he just believes her and doesn't find the idol. Now, I find it very ironic that Laban's gods were hidden away from him while his daughter sat on top of them, while the true God had appeared to him the night before in a dream, had come to him. It shows the utter silliness and usefulness of man-made idols. And it shows you the depravity of man all in the same sentence here, all in the same passage. You would think that common sense would have told Laban that he was serving the wrong God. I mean, just this little interaction common sense would have told him that. But common sense is no match for the depravity of man, and we see that here. Now, who knows how long this search took, but we see that he didn't find them. And as Jacob finds out that that Laban can't find these idols, Jacob responds very angry. It says in verse 36, then Jacob became angry and berated Laban. Jacob said to Laban, what is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? For you have felt through all my goods. What have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that they may decide between us two. These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, and I have not eaten the rams of your flocks. What was torn by wild beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. For my hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was. By day the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I have been in your house. I have served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, had not been on my side, surely you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. I can only imagine Laban feeling dumber and dumber, really, as this search goes on, and he finds nothing. After giving up finally, he goes to Jacob, let him know he couldn't find anything, and it seems like Jacob finally loses his cool a little bit, loses a little bit of composure about his relationship with Laban. He still has no idea that Rachel did, in fact, take these idols. So to him, he thinks Laban has just used this as a ruse or an excuse to pursue him and to come after him. And honestly, Jacob's probably right that that was really just an excuse. Again, that probably was not even part of the main reason why Laban had gone after him. It was all that Jacob had taken in the flocks and in the livestock that he had taken. But he's finally had enough, and he lets Laban know how poorly he'd been treated over these years and how he'd borne so much in working for him. He'd taken so many losses. Laban had treated him so unfairly during this period of time. Jacob had borne the loss of livestock that was out of his control, which would have not been proper custom. He'd suffered through cold nights and hot days, and he'd lost many nights of sleep in serving Laban. But yet he'd still served him faithfully for 20 years. Again, 14 for his wives, and the last six he'd served him faithfully in spite of changing his wives or his wages so often. Then we see Jacob's faith on display again here as he fully acknowledges that God had been the one to protect him through all of this. And that God had not been protecting him. If God had not been protecting him, then Laban would have sent him away without anything. Jacob tells him that for those reasons, and for his mistreatment of him, God had come to him last night, and that was the reason he did. He came to rebuke him for how he had treated him. Laban responds in verse 33, "Then Laban answered and said to Jacob, 'The daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day for my daughters or for their children whom they have borne? Come now, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me.' So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar, and Jacob said to his kinsmen, 'Gather stones,' and they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Laban called it Jegar Sahudatha, but Jacob called it Galid, or Galid. Laban said, 'This heap is a witness between you and me today.' Therefore, he named it Galid and Mizpah, for he said, 'The Lord watch between you and me when you are out of one another's sight. If you oppress my daughters or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no one is with us, see, God is witness between you and me.'" After hearing this response from Jacob, and without really any other options, especially considering the dream that he'd had the previous night and what God had told him, Laban offers a covenant of peace to Jacob here. But he does so with one last attempt to save his own pride. He tells Jacob that Leah, Rachel, his grandsons, all that Jacob had in the flock, and all that he could see was his, was Laban's. Not Jacob's, was Laban's. Yet, he'd let Jacob have them for the sake of his kids and for his daughters and his grandkids. That's really ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, considering everything, Laban had no more right to Leah and Rachel. They were Jacob's wives. He had no more right to them. He had no right to his grandsons. They were Jacob's children. And Jacob had worked fairly and earned the wages in the flocks that he had. Laban had no more right to them either. Most importantly, God had blessed Jacob with them. Since God had given those things to Jacob, Laban certainly had zero claim on them at this point. But they both agree to this covenant, and they set up a stone pillar as a marker of the covenant and as a boundary, as we'll see. Laban calls here for Jacob not to oppress Rachel and Leah and not to take any other wives but them. Again, the irony here is thick. Laban had no problem with multiple wives when he tricked Jacob to take Leah first and then to marry Rachel to him as well. And he cared very little for how much he oppressed them as he constantly tried to cheat Jacob throughout their entire relationship. But yet here he wants to make sure that he's upholding some pillar of honesty and some pillar of love for his children. This pillar here served as a boundary between the two families. As we read in verse 51, it says, "Then Laban said to Jacob, 'See this heap and the pillar which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness and the pillar is a witness that I will not pass over this heap to you and you will not pass over this heap to me and this pillar to me to do harm. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us.' So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac, and Jacob offered a sacrifice in the hill country and called his kinsmen to eat bread. They ate bread and spent the night in the hill country. Early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his grandchildren and his daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned home. So this pillar was to serve as a boundary. Neither were to cross it to do the other harm. Now, Laban knew that at this time, and apart from God's warning here, he had the upper hand on Jacob, that he could have done Jacob harm. But he also knew firsthand how blessed Jacob was and that God was with Jacob. So I'm sure he figured that at some point, Jacob would gain enough power that had he wanted to have any type of revenge on Laban for how he treated him, he could have come back and done Laban harm. And so I think with that in mind, he sets this as a boundary, and they're not to cross if they're going to do each other harm. They'll remember this covenant that they're not to do each other harm. And Jacob agrees to this, and he called all the kinsmen there to be witness. We're told that Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac, which is just another form of the name of God, just another reference to God. Then we see the next morning, Laban kissed his family goodbye, and he went back to his home. Now, as we wrap this up, I think we see Laban here, honestly, as a tragic example. As Henry Morris says about him, Laban is an unfortunate example of a worldly covetous man, one who knows about the true God and to whom a thorough witness has been given. He'd seen the reality of God in the life of Jacob, along with the power of God and his blessing and protection. He himself had enjoyed many of the blessings of God through his relationship to Jacob. Nevertheless, he continued in idolatry and covetousness, seeking material gain for himself to the exclusion of all other considerations. Rather than seeking to follow the truth of God's plan as witnessed by Jacob, he merely resented and coveted the blessing of God on Jacob. He finally ended up with neither. His life constitutes a sober warning to a great host of semi-religious but fundamentally self-worshipping and self-seeking men and women today. And I think that sums up Laban very well. Laban stands before us as a grave warning. There are many, especially here in America, who know of God. They've been to church, they've been exposed to preaching or singing about God or something about God during their lives. There are many who've been an indirect recipient of God's blessings. Maybe they are children of saved parents or a spouse to a child of God. Or maybe they're like Laban and have seen the power of God in their own life or someone close to them. Maybe they'd been in a horrific wreck and God spared their life, or it had a terrible disease and God had spared them from that, even when there seemed to be no hope. Yet in any or all of those cases, they might have gone on with an outward acknowledgement of God and acted like they knew Him, but they really just continued to live life their own way and worldly, which was self-serving and self-seeking, instead of turning to God. A mere head knowledge of God, or even recipient of God's blessings, does not save us. In fact, they hold us more accountable because we are given even more proof of God and who He is in those moments. If our lives show themselves to be self-serving and self-seeking in spite of what God has shown us and taught us, then that's an indication that we really don't know God. Jacob's life is one of an example for us. As we see here, Jacob certainly was not perfect. Jacob had flaws. Even at this time, after years of knowing God, he still struggles with full reliance on God. But we see steady progression in Jacob's life. We see growth. And that should be something we can say about all of our lives if we are truly Christians. There should be a constant progression in our lives. We will sin. We will struggle. But we will still move forward and grow in the grace of God. That's the sanctification process. If you claim to know Christ and claim to have known Him for years, yet there's been no growth or progression in your faith or your walk with Christ, you need to really question whether you actually know God. If you can look back and see progression and maturity, even if it's been little by little, then take comfort in that. Take confidence in that, that God has begun a work in you and He will complete it. Everyone stand with me.